If it doesn't offend you, I'm going to keep a water bottle up here this morning. That's really what I was going for. No. All right. Esther chapter 2. All right, just a quick review quiz here. Not really a quiz, but a couple questions as a way to get us back into it. Can somebody give me a couple of sentences of who King Xerxes was, both maybe from what we saw from Bill's initial lesson and what we saw in chapter 1?
Perhaps the son of Darius, I think.
Yeah, son of Darius, okay. Good guy, bad guy?
Bad guy.
Bad guy? Quick.
He showed tenderness towards Esther, though.
Not yet, but I think we'll see some tenderness come out for sure.
But he was severe.
He was severe, quick decision-making, ambitious. There's an ego here. We're dealing with an ego as a personality.
Easily
influenced, too, because he could have guys around him when he wanted that catering to his ego.
Yep. Yeah, lots of catering to his wants and needs. We'll see more of that today. What about the state of the nation of Israel at this point?
Jews had returned, but they were building the...
Jews had returned, yeah. The temple had been rebuilt. The walls maybe around Jerusalem were still in the works. Probably one of the... Oh, go ahead.
And there was a scattering of them, too.
There was, yeah.
There was concentration of them building them, but there was a scattering of
them. Mm-hmm. That's right. And that might have something to do with Israel and Judah, maybe a little bit. I don't know. But, so we find them all over, even though they had returned to Jerusalem. And this is one of the last few narratives of the Old Testament, right? We're nearing the time frame of any of the books in the Old Testament.
Still large enough that they're seen as a threat to, as we find out later in the story, to... those of
they're still a nation, yeah, absolutely, and they could be a threat to any empire. And it'd been about 120 years since the nation was destroyed and the people were sent away, which is kind of important, just knowing how old Mordecai was and things of that nature. And then in chapter 1, Xerxes throws this party. What is it? A big party. Six months of partying capped with a week of extra hard partying, maybe to prep his soldiers to get ready to go to war, get everyone psyched up, all the maybe some political nature. You know, you bring in this faction and that faction and mix them together, make everybody drunk, merry, and together, ready to go. And Xerxes gets mad at the queen, Vashti. Any reasons for that?
She didn't come when he wanted her to come.
Yeah, he called her to come parade herself in whatever nature that really meant, and she refused. And at the end of the chapter, what do we see as her punishment?
Whatever that means.
She's pulled away, for sure. And so all that brings us into chapter 2, and we start to see some characters here, there's a few characters in here that Herodotus writes about. I think all that's really cool. Just Haggai is one of the eunuchs that we find in some other writings from other cultures, which brings a lot of, not necessarily validity, I don't need that, but there's a lot of contemporary writing that brings another layer, another element to these characters. It kind of brings them to life, maybe. So let's look in chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. I think there's a few things to unpack here. Okay, how long, if you just look at this verse, how long had it been?
Seven years. Well,
not in this verse. You're right. It reads very casually, though, doesn't it?
We think it's tomorrow.
Yeah, like That's right, yeah. You know, maybe 25 days later, he's like, oh, I'm kind of sorry for what I... No, he goes, he had this whole party to go to war. He goes to war in Greece and gets beat down, comes back, and it's this whole embarrassing story, and his ego's blown. And 3 years later, when we find later down, it's 4 years, but there was a year of prep period, so we've got to back, you know, there's 4 years later, and then we back up a year, so we know it's about 3 years later. He's had a whole war that he's lost, and now his ego's blown. What do you think life in the palace was like at this time? Oh, he's come back from war. Yeah, he's come back from war. He has no queen.
I'd say everybody's taking low and high.
Yeah, there's probably lots of waving of the hands and bad moods and off with their heads and I don't like this for dinner. I think that's maybe true. Everyone in the palace is on guard, is in a bad mood, and is watchful. And a guy with this much ego doesn't just take this casually and just bounce right back. And here we see him. And he's kind of reminiscing over the loss of his queen. And, you know, this word abated or satiated, it kind of has a very particular definition of conclusion. And some have suggested after Vashti was finally killed. I don't think we've really gotten to the law of the Medes and the Persians. And I think it's referenced in here a couple of times for a very particular reason. Does anybody know, at least in the context of this story, anything important about the law? Yeah.
Once the law exists, it could be repealed.
Yeah. Even the emperor who signs the law could not undo what he did. And you can see him sitting there thinking, I was stupid, foolish, idiot. You know, but he has no ability to go and revise this law that he signed now 3 years back, even if Vashti was still around. He couldn't do anything about it. And so he's just in a bad mood altogether. It's interesting that this happens, this word I mentioned, satiated, it does mean sinking down. And we're going to read in a little bit about the 10th month of the year, which some have suggested is the most rainy month in Jerusalem, and it was named that because you actually sink down in mud. I don't know if that has anything to do with this, but it's also when Esther would suppose this whole story happens as she sinks down into the mud of the Persian realm. So maybe there's something there. So just a quick pause. There is so much written from Jewish folklore, or maybe you could call it fan fiction, about this story. And you can kind of see why. Again, it was at the end of the Old Testament, and it is a story of Jewish success. It is a story of heroism in the face of an ungodly presence. I'm sorry. I thought I hit mute. You can find all kinds of things that have no biblical context whatsoever. There's all this stuff written about Mordecai. There's even a lot written about Esther. And there's a lot in the folklore about Persia and particularly Ahasuerus. And one of the things that's interesting about most of this writing, Josephus writes about it. We see it in the Maccabees. They reference this story. Is it's all meant to whitewash a very questionable story. We want to look at these heroes and make the best of it. We want to make it something pure and perfect. And I'm not sure that's the case here. At least the biblical narrative doesn't make that clear for us. But everything has a reason. Mordecai was a member of the Sanhedrin and knew 70 languages, and that's how he got to where he was and all these other things. I think what we're about to read is something a little bit difficult to process and something that may or may not be what God would have had a child of his do. And so I'll leave you with that context as we get into the story here in Esther in verse 2 through 4. Let's read those verses real quick. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers and in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young women who please the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and so he did. What if you were teaching this class to a bunch of middle schoolers, what would you say is the context of what the counselor's suggestion is here?
Delicately.
Delicately. Finding a new wife through a beauty contest, maybe, right? I mean, that's a very simple way to put it. there was part of the law really wanted to put there's these seven leading families in Persia, and the emperor should have chosen from these seven families. There's a lot of politics and marriage and things, as we all know, in these cases. And what we see here is his counselors are actually saying, no, don't do that. And what should we read from that context? I mean, we could say, okay, there's no politics, but...
That there is.
Yeah.
There are external influences on the king.
Well, outside the norm?
Yeah, it's outside the norm for what reason, though?
Well, if you're going to exclude the politics, I assume it means that they're looking for a woman that will truly please the king and no other ulterior motives.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe something about the cultural mix. My head was with Brian here. This is all about making the king happy. And that is the context of this whole thing. They're throwing everything else out the window to find something to change the mood in the palace, if you will. Yeah, Albert.
This is a question. So, grammatically or sentence structure. In verse 4, where it says, who pleases the king instead of Vashti, if I jump back into chapter 1, she was told she would never be able to go before the king again, so she's still in the role of queen, and so they're trying to find somebody to now become queen?
I think you could read it that way, or I think you could read, maybe there's been no queen since Vashti. Part of this folklore that I was telling you about suggested that there was a wooden statue of Vashti in the king's chambers, and every woman that would come to him would have to stand in comparison to this statue. I mean, again, folklore, I don't know. But he was, whatever the case was, the queen had not been replaced, at least in the mind of Ahasuerus. And I think that's definitely true. No matter how that was accomplished. But the king was to be chosen based on not her political presence, not her family, not her heritage, but solely on her ability to please both the eye and the king. You know, this almost takes on a fairy tale, and I'm not talking Disney, but a traditional fairy tale. Who's the fairest of them all semblance, right? And we see some pretty heavy concepts here. A harem invokes very definite, particular things that probably wouldn't surprise us about a Persian emperor from 400 BC, right? You know, like that's not a surprising concept, even if it's repulsive to us today. And eunuchs, we read about this eunuch Haggai. What do we know about him?
Who?
Haggai.
He's
a eunuch. He must have been the most trusted eunuch. You could say a couple of things about that, I suppose. You could say maybe he was... Yeah, Ian, go ahead.
Do we know? Did you say something about where these women came from? I can't I may have missed it, but the virgins that he is in charge of, the women, I assume this is a select group of chosen women, probably from all of the provinces that the king ruled over, and this is probably the cream of the crop, or like politically significant women potentially.
Yeah, there's definitely something to that. We'll learn about another eunuch later. Apparently there was three houses in the palace of the women in Ahasuerus's, the walled, fortified portion of a city. And actually, that's one thing that gives a lot of credence to this story, is there's enough particularities about the palace that there's historical artifacts that evidence the same particularities. But this was the third house that Haggai was responsible for, and it was that of the virgins. So these are the women who had never gone before the king. There's another one we'll read about that is of the women who have since become not virgins. And then there was another house for the queen in particular. And we see that there's something to be given to the women here.
Cosmetics,
right? This is, and we'll read a little more detail, but I think in the Old Testament, when we read this kind of language, we read it as the purification or the sanctification, something maybe a little more with a religious overtone. That is expressly not the language used here. This is all about aesthetic and beauty. And you can imagine the folklore again suggests that 400 women were chosen. I don't know how true that is, but if you go and find 400 women from the provinces of the empire in 400 BC, what is the state of a lot of these women or people in general?
Poverty,
rough, unkempt, and this king thinks of himself as, I mean, if you've seen the movie 300, maybe you have a visual image. He thinks of himself as a deity. You don't just take someone from the gutter and put them in front of this king. Again, not to glorify that, but I think that you could see that year of waiting has a point, right? And that is maybe sanitary. Some things are washable, some things are not. You don't find that out overnight. And I think we see a lot of that going on. Okay. We've spent a lot of time here. We probably need to move on. But any other questions or thoughts on this section? All right. Esther 2, 5 through 11. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in the Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him, meaning Esther pleased him, and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with the cosmetics and her portion of food, with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. All right, so we finally get some Jewish characters into this story, right? We meet Esther and Mordecai in this passage. Mordecai is a favorite of the Jews. I mean, they They write about him. They have this feast that we learn about later that's all about him. In fact, there were some versions of this book that were the Book of Mordecai. We call it Esther, which is kind of interesting. But clearly he plays an important part. And we talked a lot about Esther in one of Bill's classes and her name and what all that means. Does anybody remember what the definition of her name was? Star is the Persian term for Hadassah.
Myrtle.
And Myrtle is the name of Esther in Hebrew. And a comment. I think that's interesting. You know, it's a sweet, very green concept. I may want to come back to this later in the class, but in Isaiah 55:13, it reads, instead of the thorn shall come up a cypress tree, and instead of a briar shall come up the myrtle tree. And it shall be to the Lord for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. And I don't mean to intend that this is saying that this is a prophecy of Esther, but certainly Esther is rising from grounds of a place that she shouldn't be naturally, you know, and we don't see God called out in this book, which we've talked about maybe a couple of times already, but certainly we see Esther rising in a non-natural setting here, and I think there and that is to show God's favor and his ongoing salvation, that he will not cut off those who are his people, which I think is a major theme through the book. Mordecai, many think there is some etymology here that refers to Marduk, who is a deity of the Persian, you know, a titan-type deity of the Persian book of gods. It actually, interestingly, means be bold and audacious in acts of rebellion, which is kind of an interesting name for a captive in a Persian city. And also gives credence to the fact that he was probably born in captivity. We talked a little bit a couple of weeks ago, or last week, I guess it was, that this was probably his great-grandfather. What Kish was actually abducted from Jerusalem. And here, 120 years later, we have a couple of their descendants with very Persian names. It is interesting that this is going to take course over a year, right? This isn't something that just happens overnight. When we think about pleasing the powers that be, it's all the time immediate gratification. There is something in the law or culture that is really kind of slowing this down, which I thought was a peculiar observation as well. And then we find out that Mordecai lives within the city walls, however you want to read that. What is his relationship to Esther? His uncle was her father.
Cousin.
Yeah, so they're cousins. It's hard to keep track. Does the law say anything about a Jewish man taking care of his cousin? Not directly, right? What does this say? This probably says I thought of two things this probably says about Mordecai. He had a good heart.
So they didn't go to where they had to marry in the family again.
Yeah, I don't know if it has to do with the marriage there. I think what it shows is he understood the spirit of the law, though,
yeah.
Right? And that taking care of this young Jewish woman who was orphaned in captivity was, I mean, the opposite of how we see all the Pharisees and Sadducees acting, right? Like they wanted to go throw their own parents away because they wanted to go tithe. I mean, they were trying to follow the law. So, well, I think this just shows someone that, whether or not they were super intimate with the law, I don't know that we can glean that from Mordecai. But he had the heart, he had the understanding, and was kind and caring to Esther. You know, there are some language spoken here about how Esther was taken, and the Jews really play on this language like it was an abduction. Maybe Mordecai would have tried to hide her, and I don't see that here at all. Of course, they're trying to find justification for why Esther's in this situation. There's some of that whitewashing that I was going on about earlier, but certainly this doesn't seem like the most voluntary thing you want to do. You know, we'll talk about this more in a minute, I'm sure, but when you go to the king for this night and you come back to this other house in the harem, what's probably true or definitely true? You're never going to
return
to normal life and lead a normal family and have a... Basically, you're a prisoner just because of the emperor's own vanity. And he's not going to share you as a woman with anybody else.
I think it's interesting... Sorry, thanks, Michael. That he didn't marry, Mordecai didn't marry her. If they were similar in age, I would assume they would be. Because you would think then, if it was she was taken, that wouldn't have happened specifically. If he would have married Esther, but so maybe that speaks again the providence of God at work. That if that had happened, you know, Esther wouldn't have been put in the position she was for redemption of the people. So to me, yeah, I was thinking originally about this that it maybe it's observation that I'm surprised that maybe there wasn't that type of relationship between.
Maybe Mordecai was married already. I don't know. and so, anyway, I guess the point, even if there isn't 400, however many women there is, you're at a lotto chances of winning everything as queen, which is debatably attractive, or living a life of, imprisonment, maybe even... You could call it sexual imprisonment. This is not a good thing to be selected as this harem here.
Imagine these 400 women bickering among
themselves. Oh my goodness. Yeah, Miss Lucille's imagining all these women put into one house and getting along so well. Interesting. I mean, that's an interesting point. We'll keep reading here. We don't really see them hating on Esther, all these other women. At least in the story. Yeah.
I have more of a clarifying question for myself because I'm kind of confused with the story of kind of what's happening. So these virgins, was it a group of 400 that you're saying?
Of course, 400.
And so they were used, you're mentioning lottery, and are you saying that they were there to potentially become queen if he picked them?
That's right.
And so we're thinking Mordecai applied Esther to this thinking that in a loving way, I guess, or was it more of a...
I think he had a choice. I think every, the way I read it is every young woman of eligibility was brought into a selection committee. You know, we see that there's governors appointed to go find these women from all over, right? And you get the impression that all the young virgins were presented and 400 might have been selected from the entire nation into this harem.
Yeah, so here,
yeah, he goes, he's not just getting rid of her. That's right, yeah. Yeah, Brian.
An interesting passage is that Mordecai told her not to disclose her heritage, which leads you to wonder, speculate on why.
And we're going to speculate.
Okay, one of two things. Number one, that she identified as a Jew, as one of the conquered people, might not be pleasing to the king, so he told her to be quiet, which would then suggest that she wasn't abducted, that he wanted her to become queen.
Could be. We can talk about it. I mean, I think there's several different possibilities, one of which, as you suggest, is the Jews are a hated group in many empires across time and history, or time and geography, and maybe just being known as a Jew was not a good thing at all. It could be that being from the Kish lineage and and what we see. Does anybody have enough recollection? I wouldn't have, to know what this means as far as her genealogy. She's a descendant of Saul. Yeah, that's right. So what does that make her? Royal bloodline. You know, these might be contradictory options. Maybe it's just that Mordecai was known in the city and didn't want to be chosen or not chosen based on his position in the city. He obviously sits in the king's gate a little later on. That whatever the reason was, he has asked her to be silent. And we can't pin that down, but certainly there are some good reasons maybe for her to keep her mouth shut, maybe just to keep herself alive. I'm not sure.
At this point, we can just say it was a good decision on his part.
It was, yeah. It was certainly for the narrative of the story, it played out well. Yeah, Justin.
To be in the position of queen, traditionally, would the monarchs of Persia have been anything other than Persian?
I get the feeling they were a lot more fluid with the different nationalities that were both in their courts and maybe in their families. So
maybe just 2 points. If at the beginning, you know, again, that where the men are telling the king, let's go to all the provinces. So my assumption would be that she was foreign and that people would know she was foreign because, again, why go to all the provinces to find all these fair ladies and whatnot? So I think that comes with it a connotation that they're probably not going to be native Persians. But then two, from Esther's, well, I'll tell you what, I'll leave it at that.
I think that's true of the group of the whole, right? It's interesting that Esther comes from just outside the palace. It took me a long time of not thinking about this before I thought about it, but anti-Semitic, does anyone know what that really means? Why we say that that way?
Anti-Jew, anti-Semite.
Which stems from who?
Shem.
Yeah. So, and to say anti-Semitic is all the descendants of Shem, which includes Persians. Do we remember where Abraham came from? This very region of the world, right? So these are actually somewhat relative. I mean, yes, hundreds of years have passed, but maybe there's a possibility that there's some semblance of between the Persian and the Jew.
And I'm sorry, one more thing. But also, because the plot's going to come up against the Jews, maybe that, to Brian's point about why did he say something, well, maybe one, this isn't the first time. Maybe this was somewhat common. So, you know, that could tell us in of itself right there.
Well, there's 8 or 9 verses that suggest that throughout the book. We haven't gotten to, but definitely.
Was Persia known as like a kind of polytheistic society where they clearly had many gods, but were they accepting of other religions as well? Meaning like Judaism and Christianity would have been kind of like separated out in a polytheistic society because they believe in one god, but other religions who believe in many gods may have been accepted more because they're kind of generally in the same category, whereas Christianity, Judaism is one God and one God only.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert in this, but King Cyrus, which would have been some level of great-grandfather of Xerxes, made the decree to give all this money back to Jerusalem, to go back to the temple in Jerusalem. And in fact, there's this really famous urn where it talks about this transaction, which is just so cool. I mean, right, that there's an urn with this story of Ezra inscribed upon it. But they believed in this faith that was founded by a guy named Zoroaster, and he essentially said that things are really just a balance. And so if you went to war and you stomped on these people, well, there's a chance their God may be real. And you don't really want to offend that God. And so you want to kind of bring things into balance. So the more you go and pollute the world with your empire, the more you want to give back to kind of keep that balance in line. If you found that balance at the end of the day, you know, you would find eternal life or whatever they were looking for. So I certainly had something to do there, but there was definitely anti-Jew feelings throughout the nation, even at this time, and for good reason. I mean, Babylon, Egypt, Assyria, they'd all tried to do things with the Jews, and every time, what did the Jews do? They quit paying their taxes and they start a rebellion. Every time. You know, like, I'm not condoning that behavior on them, but they were a tough people to have in your empire, and certainly a thorn in the side. Maybe easy to hate. Esther found immediate favor in the harem, right? She's given four things. What were they?
Choice. Service.
Cosmetics, food, servants, and a very special place in the harem, right? I think this speaks to a lot of things. She probably got along well, didn't start a lot of fights. The food, the concept there really reads a lot like what we see Daniel foregoing in the story of Daniel. There's a semblance here of being assimilated with the Persian way of life. I don't think we can get away from that in the story here. And Mordecai, obviously, as Brian pointed out, cares a lot. So verse 12, I don't even know how we're doing on time here, but anyway, 12 through 14. Now, when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and ointments for women. When the young women went in to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in the custody of Shashagaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. So we talked a little bit about all this purification, but we see a little more details. Oh, 6 minutes. All right. We got a little bit to go here. We see a little bit about these houses, and I've already talked about it, but the women basically become prisoners. I mean, I'm not going to get graphic here, but if you're wondering if I'm just making too much out of this, she goes in for the night and comes out in the morning. I think there's only one law. This is not a beauty contest, right? I'm sorry, middle schoolers. This is a very real story, right? Any thoughts about that before we jump into the next part? No? All right. 15 through 18. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had taken charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loves Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So it was Esther's turn, so to speak, right? And we see here that this thing is not good for a slight cough here. We see that Esther gets her turn and she gets the choice to take anything in with her. And what does she choose?
It's confusing. The eunuch
It's confusing me as to whether or not the eunuch told her in advance what to request, or whether she just said to the king, whatever the eunuch says. But we don't know what it was. But obviously she didn't ask for anything of greatness that it appealed to the king to see her humility.
That's right.
I think you encapsulated it. She was not depending on other things to attract the king other than herself. Maybe she, you know, there's this whole narrative, you could read this whole narrative by not saying she was royal and not selecting great things. Maybe she was trying to stay humble and stay out of the king's way. On the other hand, maybe there was a lot of wisdom in these selections and things. There's one thought that she relied on the eunuch, because who would know better than anyone else what the king wanted? And she took what he had in mind. Whatever it was, showed the right amount of wisdom to accomplish pleasing the king very greatly. She immediately gets a crown, and the king gives the crown. The king gives tax breaks. The king gives gifts. What does it take to make a king like this, who's just lost a major war, all of a sudden just start giving out money across the countryside?
He's happy.
He's happy. For whatever creepiness that may be, he is pleased and he is happy here. Verse 19 and 20. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. I don't know why those virgins are brought again the second time. How can a virgin be brought again a second time? Maybe this was a new group. I don't know the narrative here. But nonetheless, we'll go back to a little folklore. The Jews said the king was so jealous to know what her people was that he brought more virgins in to try to influence her, to make her jealous to tell the truth. But whatever the case is, she would not disregard the word of Mordecai, and she kept her secret. The king is pleased. There's some level of anonymity here that she's carrying with her, and that wooden statue that may or may not have existed has now been replaced by Queen Esther in the chamber of the king. A good place to be for someone who had to go through all this as the elect of the emperor. And we'll look down to the last two verses, verse 21 and 23, and the narrative shifts a little bit to Mordecai. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai. And he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Was Mordecai given a place in the king's gate because of Esther? I don't know if we know the answer to that. Is that why maybe these two men were thrown out of the king's gate? Again, I don't know why, but nonetheless, they were upset about, it seems, Mordecai serving in this position. And however he found out, their goal was not to take out Mordecai, interestingly enough. That will be the narrative of the rest of the book. Their goal is to take out the emperor himself, right? And Mordecai learns of it, runs it up the channel through Esther. The king finds out and his life is saved. And they write it in a book of Chronicles. That is going to be important later in the story. But it was meaningful enough for the king to have it written down. Whew, we've just barely made it. So on to chapter 3 on Wednesday night.
So what does it mean to be at the king's gate?
It,
as the